This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Paul Hertnecki grew up near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, at a time when the steel industry kept many families afloat. His town, Ambridge, was a place full of working-class people, including immigrant families from all over Europe, that found themselves down on their luck when the steel industry fell apart. In his new memoir, Rust Belt Boy, Hertnecki writes about how this town left an indelible mark and still has a pull on him, even now as he lives hundreds of miles away in Hancock, New Hampshire. He joins me now to talk about his book. Welcome, Paul.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask you to start us off by reading a brief portion of your book, a paragraph from the chapter called Where Stories Went to Die.
Okay. From the time I was a toddler, my father slowed the car as we passed Beyer's twin Bessemer converters that were open to Duss Avenue. I would stand on the back seat and watch the giant thermos-shaped smelters tip skyward and shoot flames, sparks, and gobs of molten iron into the night air. 30 feet tall and girded with heavy iron, these twin behemoths exhaled a sulfurous cloud that bathed the Ford in a warm wave, like standing in front of Godzilla when he's really pissed off. And I saw that show and felt that breath every week. Awesome. It ignited something in me that still burns.
What is that something?
I think it's the heat of industry. You know, I'm a fan of factory tours. I like seeing things be made. It's the cooperation of people to make something that's far beyond themselves. And I think that once you see the spectacle of heavy industry, whether it's the giant rooms of clattering textile looms, or it's this kind of scene, there's something about the noise, the awe of it, that takes you beyond yourself.
You've seen more than just a tour of these places. You took some time away from college to actually work in one of these. Tell us about your experience working in an industry like this.
It's really hard to describe because it's been described in cliche ways so many times. Steel workers being roughnecks and kind of brutal men. But there were women in the mill as well. And it was a very well-organized system of hard work and productivity. My part of it was frightening a little bit because I was in a mechanical labor gang, which meant that we were responsible for maintaining the mill. And we had to go into difficult, dangerous places all the time. You really see a need for a labor union when you're in that situation because I was repeatedly asked to put myself into really, you know, death-defying situations, and a few times had to ask for the union to step in and make a ruling. You know, one time in particular, I was standing on top of a 5,000-gallon tank, a 50-foot wall that was about 2.5 feet wide, and this wall went down into the tank, and there was a roof covering that was supposed to be put over it. We were putting girders on top of the roof. And I was asked to stand on a 50-foot wall, or wall 50 feet high, with 4 inches of water below it, using a 30-pound jackhammer to, quote-unquote, chip out the concrete. If I'd lost the hammer, I would have gone to the bottom of the tank. And so they fixed it by bringing over a hoist crane, putting me into a harness, and having me chip out this space. But every time I leaned on the hammer, my feet came off the ground because I was on a hoist.
Wow.
So it was kind of a silly ballet of trying to get a job done. But there were. So sometimes we were outside. I drove railroad spikes first with a maul and learned how to do it. I still know how to split wood efficiently because of that. And then we drove spikes with a jackhammer after a while.
And that's the kind of work that when you were a kid, I mean, parents were doing, uncles, fathers. When you were a kid, how aware of the dangers that your family members were in when they went to work were you?
Pretty aware, since occasionally news of a critical injury would come down, or even a death. I remember when our next-door neighbor, Rudy Henger, who was a production guy at the Armco steel mill, where we made pipes, slipped and fell down a mountain of pipe and was crushed and was, he lived, but he was never the same.
There was a period of prosperity when people had jobs, mm-hmm. the Vietnam War especially, there was a need for that kind of thing, materials that would support the war effort. But you write in the book that the one word that people tended to not use was unsustainable. What was it like living in that time where there was this prosperity, but there was also this feeling that this can't last?
It fed a kind of futility that we often felt, in that forces bigger than us were in control of our lives. We could see that things were not going to be sustainable, that the face of the world was changing. But I guess there was a feeling that we would just chase one opportunity into the next, and it would keep coming. My father knew better, and he thought that plans should be made for the industry modernizing. But as it turns out, globalism really had its way. And we saw the handwriting on the wall. We saw the, you know, the Asian characters written on steel blooms. So we knew that things were being done differently. And I don't think there was a whole lot of innovation happening. And they weren't really thinking about sustainability. I think they were, most of the corporate entities, like U.S. Steel and Armco Steel, were thinking about expansion of their businesses through different products and different endeavors. U.S. Steel got into oil exploration, for instance. So that was the model. It was more sort of the expansion, not the sustaining of current industries. They didn't reinvest in steel. That industry has a history of sort of resisting reinvention.
And because that industry was the lifeblood of so many people when you were growing up, you must have faced enormous pressure to enter that industry. And you worked in it for a short time, but ultimately you decided not to. Tell me about what it felt like to choose something, to choose sort of a life, the life of the mind, which was not what was happening predominantly in your culture when you were growing up.
Yeah, I think, you know, most people were encouraged to go to trade school so they could do something that our parents understood, that our community understood. It was great if someone wanted to go into college to become a doctor or a lawyer. There were kind of very specific things people thought about. But when you go to college and major in English literature, you're obviously just scratching an itch and following your curiosity, which is what I was doing.
With the intent of possibly going to law school.
With the intent of possibly going to law school, right. Mm-hmm. But I was interested in English literature, and I was not interested in teaching it. So go back to your question again. Could you rephrase that? Am I answering it?
Yeah. Well, the question is, I mean, you pursued a life of the mind because, as you write in your book, it was just this curiosity that you had about the world that seemed to push against the boundaries of Ambridge and the steel towns in general. Like, you wanted to know things. You wanted to know the world and travel the world. And that went against the grain of what was happening around you.
And how that felt, I remember you asked how it felt. For a long time, it meant that I was poor relative to my peers. They went into the mills and they made serious money. They bought houses. They bought duplexes. They bought boats.
This is
cars.
When you were in your 20s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was trying to, you know, make it as a writer, as a advertising writer at first, and then going into the publishing industry.
And so you see your friends sort of, they took the trade school route. They had a job right away, and you were sort of, you almost took the hard path.
Yeah, they were killing it. They were doing great economically, but I looked at what they had to do every day, and I'd done that for a while, and I realized it just wasn't for me, just because I couldn't be compensated really well for what I liked to do didn't mean I was going to give up my dream of having my curiosity be something that I could trade upon.
And you teach now, right? You teach it?
I teach as a small part of my freelance career.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering how your experience growing up in Ambridge informed your teaching.
I never give up on anyone. I can tell you that. I think it makes me a curious teacher. I'm very curious about what my students bring to the table. And I don't necessarily think I see it all the time very readily, or that they're showing it, especially as writers. And I feel like often there are things they're afraid to write about. They're embarrassed to write about. They feel as though they have to fit into a particular form. And I think that nonconformist, unconventional thing is what I'm after as a teacher.
Why do you think your students feel that way? I should say that you teach, your university teaching happens in Pittsburgh.
It happens in Pittsburgh for a while. For 16 years, it happened in Keene, though.
Oh, okay.
And at Antioch. I think students feel that way because there are, even if you hear poets today, 8 out of 10 poets will read in a particular way. There are forms that writers feel like they have to fall into. And I'd like to dissuade them away from those forms and into something else. I also feel like one of the things that I bring to it as a former blue-collar guy is that I know that there are majority of people out there don't read any books. And they maybe they read one book a year. It's my responsibility as a writer and as a teacher of writing to teach students and to model never taking for granted a reader's time or attention. So every word, every sentence, every paragraph, I try to encourage them to pay attention to holding that reader through the entire thing. That's how it affects it most, I think.
For this book, you've done a book tour. You've gone a variety of places, including Ambridge. What was it like returning to Ambridge with this book and sharing these stories to people who may have lived with you or under similar circumstances?
It was overwhelming, Peter. First of all, there's no bookstore in my hometown. There's never been one. But there was the library that I actually wrote about in the book. And they were enormously welcoming. And the town turned out. There were teachers there that I'd had. There were fellow students. There were young people, older people, people who are characters in the book. It was overwhelming. I had a hard time keeping it together during the reading. But we, you know, as is our culture, we all went out to eat afterwards, too, at a local bar. So I at first thought people would have differences with the way I portrayed their lives and this place. But it really helped me to bombproof it on a blog before I published this book. So drafts and longer versions I put out there and put into enough people's hands that it became a little viral back there. And I was waiting for the brickbats to arrive, and they really didn't. So I was overjoyed to go back there and read for those people. I feel like when I'm hearing from a wide variety of readers on this book in many parts of the country, and the one thing that seems to be in common with them, and it's not a deal breaker by any chance. They're not restricted to this. But if they've grown up in a mill town anywhere, whether it's Fall River or it's Great Falls, Rhode Island, or anywhere out west, people growing up in a mill town had a similar experience. And I am surprised at how common that experience is throughout the country.
The experience of growing up in a town that has seen its glory days gone by.
Or is based in manufacturing. Ah. Even if its glory days are still with it.
Mm-hmm.
A sort of single industry town or a company town or a mill town, something that manufactures. There were immigrants who built it. And there is no evidence yet that counters the idea that a steady flow of immigrants expands an economy. And it certainly expanded the economy post-World War II. And we've had other instances like that throughout the country. And it was certainly the story of the Rust Belt that immigrants were the ones who built it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that story has some resonance today. When we look at the immigration problem.
Quote-unquote,
the problem. We just haven't learned quite how to see it and use it as an opportunity. I say we haven't learned, but we actually have. We're doing it. But I'm not sure it has that public image.
Part of what your book seemed to be about to me was the question of nature versus nurture. Mm-hmm. To what extent is your personality sort of given to you at birth, and to what extent is it sort of created by your surroundings? And tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like your book is suggesting that there's a certain combination of nature and nurture, not versus nurture.
Yeah, I think it's a dance, Peter. I really do. I think, you know, we step a couple of different ways because of our nature, and we move a couple of other ways because of our nurture. Our dancing partner will always have effect on the moves we want to make. And we share the lead from time to time. I'm certainly a combination of those both. I love having lived in New England for most of my adult life. And it helps me see that New England really was the first manufacturing belt in this country to be abandoned. So when I go to Lawrence, Massachusetts, and Lowell, Massachusetts, and other big mill towns, Manchester, Nashua, these are places that had to recover from a heyday of industry. And they've had close to 100 years to do it. So there are painful years in that century. And I assume that Ambridge and Pittsburgh's bounced back big time. But the towns around it, it may take a while for them to come back.
So how often do you go back?
I tend to go back twice, maybe three times a year. Yeah. I still have family there.
Do you go back just for family?
I did for many, many years, and friends, because some friends there are still my best friends. But also, I'm a student of the place now, and I kind of always have been.
What do you mean?
I'm fascinated with what goes on in industrial development and post-industrial development. So that the idea, for instance, of brownfields, which everybody who's involved in any kind of urban development understands, I can't believe it doesn't get more notice. They are essentially small Superfund sites that exist throughout the country. And in many places, it's a large part of the real estate within an urban spread. I went to a brownfields conference in Boston once, and you know, one of the big brownfields projects in Boston is Kendall Square, and there have been others. And these are polluted lands, industrial lands, that if a developer takes interest in them, we have a brownfield fund in the federal government that will match the developer's investment dollar for dollar. And that's why these places have become so successful. It also prevents developers from doing greenfield development. So instead of taking virgin land and building something on it, it's an incentive for them to reclaim the land, which is entirely possible with modern technology, and build something new in an existing neighborhood. But I went to a conference on this in Boston, and they had a beautiful press room, had a big auditorium. And for 2 days in the conference, I was the only journalist in the press room.
To be a student and to study this place, do you need distance?
Yeah, I think it helps. I write very little about New England, for instance, because I live here. I also found I used to do a lot of photography when I was doing magazine journalism in places where I'd otherwise have to hire a photographer to go. I would shoot for my own stories. And I found that I would very seldom do stories about New England or about places close to me, or near to me. So Ambridge was a place I felt like I had to get away from for quite a while in order to see it not only objectively, but also to see it in a way that people outside that place would understand. What's important to a New Yorker about a place like Ambridge? What's important to a Vermonter about that, or a Californian, even if they've had no brush with it? And I think I did need that distance.
Well, Paul, thank you very much for speaking with me about your book.
Thank you, Peter. Thanks for your interest.
That's Paul Hartnecki. He's the author of the new memoir, Rust Belt Boy. Paul will be reading from his work at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord on Wednesday, July 13th at 5:30. And you can find a list of the top 5 books on Paul's bookshelf at nhpr.org. We love getting reading recommendations from listeners like you. Jane from Manchester wrote us to recommend The Sea Captain's Wife by Martha Hoad. She says, this is a nonfiction piece that chronicles the life of a New Hampshire woman, frequently indigent and exhausted, who becomes enamored with a black sea captain who she eventually marries during the American Civil War. Their interracial relationship divides her family during this very complex and bitter time in U.S. history. That recommendation of The Sea Captain's Wife by Martha Hoad comes from Jane in Manchester. What's your recommendation? Send us an email. The address is books@nhpr.org. You can also tweet us at NHPR Bookshelf. Tell us what we should bring to the beach this summer. And remember, you can listen to the archive of these conversations with New Hampshire authors at nhpr.org or by searching for The Bookshelf in the iTunes Store or Google Play. This is The Bookshelf from NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening.